The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Experience lightning fast speeds and Sky's best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
And welcome back. 51551 is the text. Ryan at RTE.ie is the email number. Now, it's a cyber thriller spy novel. It's got hacking in it. It's got tech billionaires, twisty plot. But This Eden, the new novel from Man Booker, long-listed Ed O'Loughlin, has a point to make as well. Good morning to you, Ed, in studio.
Good morning. Great, glad to be here.
It's nice to be face-to-face, you know, as we get into the tech thing. It's like we're off the grid or something.
Yeah.
Also, let's start first of all, because you're Irish-Canadian. Is that your identity? Is that how you identify? And let's get into your background so that we can judge you accordingly, as is the Irish way.
Well, I was born in Canada, but I grew up here. So okay. I have two badges I can wear. But, you know, I had a Canadian accent when I moved here when I was six, but it's long gone.
Which was, I'm sure, very welcomed and not commented on at all when you came to Ireland.
I was followed around at school and called the Yank.
Okay, right.
Which could not be more Canadian.
You didn't think of putting on a maple leaf or something. That's what they have to do sometimes, the poor old Canadians. So now I got straight into the book because it was reminiscent of Dave Eggers' novel The Circle, which was a great book and a kind of a dodgy film. But we meet two people straight away who are very kind of, they're sort of victims, aren't they, of the reality that big tech has created today.
Yeah, I mean, the book starts in Vancouver because I'd read a piece in The Economist several years ago about how the property market was turning Vancouver, which had been one of the world's most livable cities, according to lots of polls, into an unlivable city. So I picked that as a starting point when I was planning the novel. But, you know, as it moved on, I quickly realized that I could have just as soon have set it in Dublin. But
and of course, we soon meet the, is it Taus? Is that how you connect?
Taus.
He says some pretty grim stuff about cyber warfare, and he's teaching these two. Well, he's teaching the kids involved, aren't they? I mean, start off, sorry, with the character. Like I said, two different victims. You've got Michael, he's in the gig economy, and tell us about his girlfriend, who's kind of the centre point at the beginning.
His girlfriend, who he's been with since college, is they're both engineering students, but she's a very good engineering student, and he's a very poor one. So she goes into software engineering and then drops out because she's one of these people like Bill Gates and so many others in Palo Alto who are so good at computers they don't have to have a degree. But he's struggling, and she gets involved in all kinds of behind-the-scenes activist activities, and he can't really keep up with her, and they grow apart and things happen.
Yeah, and then he gets drawn into a world which he's not really prepared for.
He's completely sucked into this world. He does not belong there, and he has to... he gets recruited, unbeknownst to himself, into a plot to save the world.
Yeah, and this is where this Taus character we meet, he's sort of an activist, and there's also there's the billionaire, Campbell Fess.
Yeah.
And so this Michael goes to meet him, and that's where I thought we were going to end up, in this kind of glass building in Silicon Valley for the whole thing, but obviously things move along very quickly. But we're in this world, and it straight away feels very sinister, even though it looks very pretty and it feels like this is the future.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we're all seeing now the world we live in. We were being promised 20 years ago how the internet would change everything for the better. And while, you know, we're all addicted to it and it's very useful, it does have a very dark side. And that's, you know, where the idea from the novel came from, that we are living in a kind of a dystopian tech thriller, whether we like it or not. You know, if you write about kitchen sinks, that's no longer the realism. This is our new realism.
Mm. And is there a moment in time that you can kind of pick that sort of, because initially people were going, these are great fun renegades, the guys in hoodies who have disrupted old sectors that maybe needed to be disrupted because they were also monopolies in their own way. It seems to be around Cambridge Analytica, around that Facebook and the manipulation of data for the US elections in 2016. Was that the key turning point where people sort of went, oh, hang on, what we're doing online is now a commodity that can be used to actually change the world around us?
Yeah, I think it became inescapable. And also we saw how tech was being used to leverage, you know, fake news, that it was being used to actually erode the very, the agreed, any consensus about what was true and what was false. And that was behind Trump. I think we see it with the Brexit campaign, and we see it further afield as well. And that's also something I deal with in the book. It's how our reality is under threat and how we have to fight to try and shore it back up again.
Because he used the term, of course, fake news, but post-truth was probably a better term, wasn't it, before that?
Yeah, or I mean, Orwell predicted it back, you know, in the 40s, that the fake, false information could be used to flood out good information.
I was referencing the Taos character, and he's the one who says all these grim things to Michael, who's learning about this world, even though he's kind of been in it. But I was particularly struck by one, which I have to ask you whether how deeply researched it. I think they're in Jersey and they're looking at all the container shipments and kind of the RFID, the digital things. And he's saying they could be just hacked very simply, and you can totally disrupt the US economy for weeks and maybe forever, totally bypassing all the tanks and missiles and the old warfare that we knew with the drop of a hat.
Yeah, well, I kind of made up that particular detail. It occurred to me, I had my characters in New Jersey anyway, looking across at Newark, and I thought, what would they see? But it does, you know, speak to a broader point, which is that the warfare which is underway now is not about dropping bombs on railway sidings and communication centers anymore. It's about dropping viruses and hacking and ransomware attacks.
Which we know about now. And obviously the word data probably was a turnoff for people where they go, well, I'm not going to understand any of that. But we've got a first schooling in the last month in Ireland with the cyber attack on the HSE.
I think everyone understands it. I mean, we don't need, it's like driving a car. We don't need to know how the car works to drive it. And we all drive cars in terms of we all have smartphones and we all have computers and we all to some degree rely on the internet. And we all see what's going on with the HSE hack. That really brought it home, I think, for people in Ireland.
Do you think, I mean, what is your message essentially here? Because people will say, you know, Facebook is the thing I get to stay in contact with someone. The pandemic has made technology really important, that people aren't as lonely because they were able to see, you know, they're able to do the FaceTiming thing. Zoom was obviously a huge thing for business as well as family and those personal connections. So it has done a substantial amount of good, hasn't it?
Well, that's the thing. You know, can we throw out the baby with the bathwater? The internet is a wonderful tool. It's just, you know, we are allowing the people who control it to do far too much with the data we give them about us. And we're allowing them to use it to manipulate us in ways that we don't fully understand or only beginning to comprehend now. And I think that the task is, you know, as with, you know, capitalism, it's poisoning the planet. But do we want to go and destroy it completely and go and live in caves or, you know, as hunter-gatherers? You know, we have to find a medium.
We still have to put ads on here and sell the book. And write
absolutely,
a book.
Yeah, yes. Buy the book.
You have to live under the system that's there. So when, because you're a journalist and you've had a long career, can you give us a kind of a brief sojourn of your travels as a journalist over the recent years?
Well, I mean, I started out in Dublin, in the Dublin Tribune, and then the Irish Times. And then the Irish Times sent me to Africa as their Africa correspondent in 94. And I ended up staying there for almost 8 years. I was back home for a year, and then the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age of Melbourne sent me to the Middle East. So I had, in total, almost 15 years as a foreign correspondent in Africa and the Middle East. And then we moved back here in 2008 when the kids came along, and it's been a lot more sedate since then.
And your wife was a journalist as well?
She was, yeah. And now she works for the Legal Services Regulatory Authority.
That's Nuala Haughey.
Communications, that's right, yeah.
And because the reason I'm asking about that is because you've turned to novels now, and I'm wondering, do you kind of see the genre of thriller maybe as a way to send the message that may not have got through or is not as easy to get through in journalism?
Yeah, in this case in particular, I mean, this is the only pure thriller I've written, and I may not write another one, but I just thought for this message and what I wanted to say, often I start off with a story and don't know why I'm writing it. In this case, I knew exactly why I was writing it, and I built the story around that purpose, and it could only really be a thriller because this is the world we live in.
So there is a message there, but maybe this is kind of the easier medium to get it through.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if you're trying to get across a serious point, sometimes it's good to put a bit of sugar around the pill.
Have you given up on journalism then? Does that mean you're kind of...
No, I still freelance a bit, but...
But in terms of the belief that this will change the world, which I'm sure you had at some point.
I think journalism is still very important and it can still change the world, but, you know, I'm a bit long in the tooth and I think it's a young person's game.
Yeah. And in fairness, technology can be turned on its head as well. I mean, the FBI thing sounds ingenious, which we're hearing in the news now, that they invented an app that they could convince criminals was going to be totally encrypted and they were going to be able to communicate with each other without any law enforcement seeing it. Little did they know the FBI had created it.
Yeah, well, that's part of the asymmetric warfare that's going on. These guys are like the pirates who represent the big empires in the 17th century. You know, Russian hackers who are in some way linked to the Russian government, they're freelance, but, you know, out in the fringes of all the shadow wars going on is fascinating.
Yeah. Now, it all sounds heavy, but of course, I have mentioned Jason Bourne because it does feel like, you know, it's an adventure thriller. Michael travels around the world. And before he even leaves America, of course, he encounters this amazing character, Aoife. Tell us about Aoife, because she is obviously the Irish figure in all of this.
Aoife is quite, in some respects, an ordinary young middle-class Irish woman who discovers she has two unusual traits. She craves adventure, she realizes, and she's very, very good at being sneaky and deceptive. She's also very brave. And because she wants a challenge in life, she ends up ditching her law degree and going to work for the Police Service of Northern Ireland. Because she'd been reading the novels of Owen McNamee, and she's got the misconception that it's all very romantic because he has all these bruised RUC characters. And she ends up going from that into British intelligence because she's just very, very good at improvising and sneaky and sneaking around. And disillusioned, she finds herself freelancing and sucked into this plot. And she ends up being kind of almost a babysitter for the male character because he doesn't know what he's doing and she does.
But she's a bit of crack, isn't she?
Oh, she's very funny, yeah.
She's you have her coming from Kildare, which was your second home after Canada.
Yeah, well, it's where I grew up. I did a lot of research for my last novel, and I thought for this one I'm going to do it the easy way. So wherever possible, I used things that I knew about already rather than do any more research.
Yeah, because they're sort of on the run constantly from the billionaires and from the kind of system we've been talking about, the data centres and the surveillance, because it's very hard to go off grid. And I found myself kind of screaming in the book going, just come to Ireland where the rural broadband scheme is, you know, sneaking along. It's even the other day in the papers, it's delayed again. So that's where ultimately they do go.
Yeah, they end up back in Dublin. The book has its denouement on the Crossguns Bridge in Phibsborough, which I thought needed to be, you know, dragged into a glamorous international spy story.
Yeah. Phibsborough, it's Phibsborough's hour, with a GH, obviously.
Yeah. Cause,
but before we get there, obviously there is a particular scene in Uganda, which, knowing that you are a journalist in Africa, it is pretty grim. Even though there's a very funny character, Bill Addison, he's a kind of a film natural, which I thought was a kind of one of those sleazy villains along the way that we encounter. But it did smack of your memories, I'd say, because you covered the Rwanda genocide, didn't you, in the mid-90s?
The aftermath, yeah.
The aftermath. Mm. Can you tell us your experience of covering that and what that did to your, you know, vocation as a journalist?
Well, that was the very first big foreign story I was sent on was the refugee crisis. The genocide, I guess, was still in some ways going on, but it was the when 1 million people crossed across the border into the DRC, Zaire, as was, and you had a cholera epidemic. So tens of thousands of people died in the space of a few days, and that was where I was thrown in. That was my very first ever, you know, big foreign disaster story. So it was a real very much the deep end. I mean, I never actually saw anything else like that in my whole time as a foreign correspondent. So I guess it must have changed me in some ways. But
do you know how much it's changed you?
No, I'm still trying to work that out.
Okay.
I didn't think about it for a long time. Probably made me more reckless and initially more arrogant.
Why was that in the kind of I've been there, seen it all?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, when you've seen something that horrific, it's probably a little bit like being in a war yourself. You react in strange ways, and I hadn't had anything to steady me before that. But you know, I've gradually come down from it now.
Okay. What was your goal in setting out on this book? I mean, where was the motivating factor? Did it come from just anger at Silicon Valley and all it stands for, or a longing for how can we escape it?
The key idea, really, I had an idea one day, which was I was thinking about money, you know, money as it's leveraged by technology, as money now lives online. I mean, what is money? You know, we have people who are multi-billionaires, and yet where is their money? It's stored in, you know, zeros and ones in servers somewhere. And you look at the way these people behave because of their money, and you have to ask yourself, do they own the money or does the money own them? Because, you know, you have vast corporations and billionaires lobbying against the fight against climate change, against the pollution of the planet. The planet's being poisoned. they live on the planet, and so do their kids, and yet they're poisoning it. And, you know, I began to wonder, you know, does the money own them or do they own the money? And I won't go into the spoilers, but...
because it gets very Matrixy then, doesn't it, when they're with the subject of money. Actually, the cover is quite Matrixy. Was that a, mind? Because you could see it on the big screen.
Yeah, I didn't design the cover. I wish I had, but there's no grotesque rave scenes in it, so it's not that Matrixy.
That's one of the sequels, surely. Where did the inspiration for the billionaire come from? The tech billionaire, Mr. Fess.
He's really pretty much a stock character. I needed a kind of a villain in the background, and you know, it's such a so obvious. You know, we don't have to name names. We see these people who are, you know, incredibly rich and who are building spaceships and, you know, trying to abandon our planet, which they're destroying. And, you know,
some people might be glad to see them.
Yeah, that's it has been questioned. How do they know if we send them off to the moon that we let them come back?
But Kamir, when you finish a book like this, do you leave it alone? Are you still wrestling with these great subjects of, you know, is big tech poisoning and destroying the planet? I mean, you have to eventually, we all have to go to the supermarket and choose a flavour of yogurt.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Come crashing back to reality.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've written the book. In fact, the book was written over a year ago and I've been kind of waiting for it to come out. So I've moved on to other things. I mean, I think I've said my piece for now. People haven't read it yet because it's only published tomorrow. But, you know, I'll see how it goes and maybe save the planet, you know, some further date, some further project in the future.
It's set in the pandemic. Actually, I've just reached the point. I'm about 100 pages from the end, and it's 13th of March, and you're writing it at that time. So it's a future dystopian book you've said that's set in the past.
Yeah, well, it was set in the present when I was writing it, okay. and then I'd already written the first draft, and it became, you know, COVID started to pop up in the news, and by February when I was doing the edits, it was clear that COVID was going to be, you know, a much bigger thing. Than we would have hoped, and so I had to rewrite it a little bit to allow for that, because it was always going to be set in that present day, and I managed to hedge the bets with COVID, and in a way having a year and a half of nothing happening is very useful for me, because I don't have to catch up.
And it's useful because they're off the grid, so they don't seem to know what's going on, and then they see a face mask appearing two-thirds of the way through.
Yeah, I think like a lot of us, they didn't know what was going on.
It's kind of the first time I've seen that in a novel. And I think it's the Sunday Times said it was the first book in a pandemic, first Irish novel set in a pandemic so far. So are we ready for
Is
that?
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, exactly. We're about to find out, aren't we? So what's next?
Well, I wrote a kind of a short memoir last year that should be out sometime next year. And I've already started writing another novel, which has nothing to do with, it's just about a very straight Irish novel about, you know, a bunch of young people going away for a weekend.
Very good, very different.
Very different, not at all a thriller. I'm not sure if anything's going to happen in it at all.
All right.
But
that's very Man Booker, is it?
I was thinking more of the Nobel. You know, I'm going to bypass
right, okay.
the Man Booker.
Why not? Look, it's great. I love this, Eden. And there's also Edda Loughlin's book, Minds of Winter, is a great read and introduction to polar exploration history for novices of that genre. I will reread it. I'm looking forward to reading his current book, too, says that texter, 51551. This Eden is out. And by the way, do you engage with tech yourself? Or do you try to live off the grid?
No, not at all. No, I'm as addicted to my phone as anybody else. I was waiting to come in the green room, you know, retweeting all the tweets saying I was going to be on your show.
Yeah.
Maximising the impact.
Because it can, like, the book is actually such fun that, and you do have this kind of sense that this is the horrible reality, the dark reality you're in. But how do you feel? Are you confident about, optimistic about the world? Because it can sound like sometimes you're not so optimistic about it.
Oh, I think naturally, intellectually, I'm quite pessimistic. But, you know, I think emotionally I am fairly optimistic. Most people are. We have that bias. And the book itself, I don't want to give away too much, but, you know, we're looking at a planet that's, you know, seems to be dying, is in big trouble. But, you know, it's not dead yet. And there are still things that could be done. And it would be stupid to just assume that, you know, we're doomed and throw up our hands in the air. You know, we can still make an effort. And if that's the only shot we have to take it.
And if David Attenborough, who's in his 90s, still shares that kind of hope as well, then there's a taste of it for all of us. This Eden, Edda Loughlin, it's out tomorrow.
Yeah.
The very best of luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Ed. Good morning to you.